Okay.
The red light's on.
It just began, yes. Okay, we are recording on 6/20/13, and I would like you to introduce yourself, please, sir. And this is Kat Everett and Antibo Sprague, and we are recording for...
Terry Grillo.
Of Volcano, California.
Of Volcano, Amador County, California.
And this will be Terry's oral history, both of his childhood in Amador County in Volcano, California, and memories of stories of parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and the huge extended family that has been home for him for some time.
Yeah. So, to start.
Dragging it closer to Terry.
You're about to say something about Evelyn Barberini.
Okay. My grandmother was her aunt. And
your grandmother was?
Sadie. Sarah Rose Gillick Grillo. That's her whole name. But everybody called her Sadie.
And Aunt Sadie.
Aunt Sadie. Everybody, she was Aunt Sadie to everybody.
She was my Aunt Sadie.
Yeah. And Evelyn was her niece, and she would visit here often. Evelyn was she looked like little Tweety Bird. She was just so small and so fragile looking. And her father was Owen Gillick, Oney, who was 6'2", looked like a mountain, you know. And this little teeny person was his daughter. Anyway, that's Evelyn, and I knew her well. Anyway.
So Evelyn Garbarini, or Evelyn Gillick.
Evelyn Gillick Garbarini.
Was Oney Gillick's daughter,
mm-hmm.
And so she grew up here in Volcano also.
Yes and no. Yeah, I suppose so.
Well, Oney was here when I was growing
up.
Yes,
but he didn't raise his family here.
Oh, okay.
I think he lived in Sutter Creek.
Ah, okay. So I didn't know that until he got older and came back.
He came back and lived here.
As an old man. Okay. Where did he live when he was an old man?
Here.
In this house?
In this house.
Really?
There was a kitchen here, which was built when my grandparents got it, they built a kitchen, and there was a bed in the kitchen. That's where he slept.
Not full address, but what street are we on here?
16234 Plug Street.
There you go.
The northeast corner of Plug and Consolation in Volcano.
But that number is way not the kind of number that was here way back when.
Actually, it's number 11 Plug Street.
Yes, number 11 Plug Street is much more realistic here.
Yeah, anyway. So, about me. I was born in San Mateo, raised on the peninsula. Went to school at Woodside High, schools on the peninsula. Woodside High School, College of San Mateo. So I'm a suburban kid. You know, grew up on the peninsula. We had family in the city. Spent a lot of time in San Francisco. And when I was younger, I think the first time I came up here for the whole summer, I might have been 9 or 10. And my parents decided that it would be good for me to grow up in the summertime with my grandmother in this house. She also did not live, this was a summer home for a long, long time. So she and my uncle would come up, he was a teacher, and every year when he got out of school, they would come up here, and they always call it going home, and she would live here with him and carry on her life here, often much, I guess, as she always had, but she really missed it and lived in the Bay Area for many reasons. Anyway, so I started coming up when I was probably 9, and the last time I came up to stay the whole summer, I was driving a car, so I might have been 16 or 17, and then I grew up, you know, and I got to be a wise guy and got, you know, a little bit older, and then that's Anne's fly. Anne's horses fly.
There are flies in this town that have nothing to do with my horses.
No, they're all your flies.
They're all my flies.
Excuse me.
Thank you. It's my recorded history. And if I want to call it Anne's fly, then by willikers I will.
That's George.
That's George Anne's fly. Anyway, So, I grew up here in the summertime, and I can recall people, I'd go back to school in the fall, and in suburban schools, I was going, you know, Selby Lane School or Goodwin Junior High School or even Woodside High School, and they would all say what they did during the summer. They had this or they did that, or and they'd say, "What'd you do?" And I go, "I went to the volcano." "What'd you do?" "Oh, I played in the creek, I built forts, helped my grandmother, went up to the mountains." They couldn't get it. But growing up here was great for me. I got a real good grounding in rural living. And I'd go back, and I can recall every older I got, the less I appreciated the crowds and the noise in the city, and the more I appreciated this. I guess this is a part of the way California's gone, but I can recall in the Bay Area where there was gaps between San Carlos and Belmont. There were dairies and goat farms mm-hmm. and stuff. And during my youth, I recall it being all filled in and paved over. Mm-hmm. And the traffic went from being not so bad to being locked up mm-hmm. on Bayshore and all this stuff that was going on. So I began to appreciate this more and more. Long story short, fast forward till I met my wife. We lived down there. I was a reporter. We were living in Menlo Park, and I was working for a Springer Weeklies, and maybe we should have stayed there because it would have been better for us financially. But we made this, we had this place to come to, so we came here, and been here for 30 years. I guess, 33 years,
mm-hmm.
32 years now. And this place was a fallen down summer house. It was just, God knows what it was. So we spent all that time going through this over and over again, rebuilding it, and trying to survive here.
Well, it's a beautiful place. You've captured the country in it and its history in it.
Yeah.
In a beautiful way.
Thank you very much. Anyway,
so I'm going to have a question, even though I sort of know the answer. So Sadie, your grandma Sadie,
uh-huh.
Aunt Sadie to me, not my real aunt.
Well, she was everybody's.
But
aunt.
She was everyone's aunt.
Everybody called her Aunt Sadie.
She would come up here with
her son James.
Her son James.
Yes.
So who was your father and mother?
Wilson. His name was Wilson, and nobody ever called him that unless they wanted to get whuffed alongside the head. It was Bill and Lee Grillo. He went away to the Second World War. Now, let me back up a little bit about Volcano. Power didn't come in here until 1933. And the story that my grandmother told was that when the day the power came in, all the women in town went to, I guess it might have been this corner here or out in Constellation, and smashed their kerosene lanterns on the ground.
Hmm.
Some of these things, I still have a few here, but some of these things had crossed on the covered wagon. They were like,
Or come around the horn.
And I said to her, Noni, I just called her the Italian name for grandmother, "Why did you do that?" And she looked at me, The Gillicks all have this look about them. When they want to get your attention or when they're serious, they give you the look. John Gillick, who's still over here, he has his son. It's genetic. Anyway, she gave me the look. And she says, "Have you ever cleaned a glass chimney?" I said, "No." She said, "Has you ever cleaned 12 of them a day?" And I said, "No, well, that's why."
That's a great story.
Yeah. So
it's also true.
It's also true.
Having done that in Wisconsin,
yeah.
The homestead we lived on.
Yeah. So,
so 2 hours of work usually.
Yeah, a lot of work. There was, she worked when she was here. She just worked from dawn to dusk all the time, keeping this place up. Anyway, so when he went away to war, he came from a place that had just had electricity. That the roads weren't paved, and if you look at a picture of Volcano from the early days, you'll know that all the trees around here are second growth. So when he was a kid, they were scrubs, little mm-hmm. scrubby trees. And he said it was cold and muddy in the winter and hot and dusty in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And he went down to the Bay Area and there was pavement and flush toilets mm-hmm. and electric lights. And you turn the faucet on, you got hot water. And he never ever wanted to come back to live here mm-hmm. because he had all those experiences. So he was in a bar in Burlingame. And he was in the Army. He was one of these guys, they said, if you enlist for 6 months, you'll avoid the draft. Well, he enlisted 4 months before Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So that didn't really work at all for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he was stationed at Tanforan Racetrack. They turned it into a barracks.
Mm-hmm.
This is in Millbrae. It's now a shopping center. And walked into a bar, and my mother was in there, and one thing led to another, and I want to say 6 weeks later, they were married. And then 3 months later after that, he went to Europe, and he didn't come back for 3 years.
Mm.
So that's who my dad and mom were. Both passed away now. But they lived in Redwood City, nice suburban home. He was he worked for Pacific Telephone, and she was a beautician.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived. They weren't wealthy, but they just show you how times have changed. They lived comfortably. They went to work and came home and had enough income to pay for their house and go places and enjoy themselves and go out. You can't do that, of course,
no.
today.
No.
So that's who they were. My uncle, his brother.
And whose parent was your grandma who lived here?
His parents.
His
parents. His mother was Sadie. Pardon me. His father was James Grillo Sr. And I'll give you a little history of the family.
That's what we want.
Okay, then. Well, all right, then. On my dad's side, on my mom's side, she comes from Southern Illinois and Southern farm girl, and that's what she was. Became a California. My mom arrived in California. She was 18 years old and came out on the city of San Francisco from Chicago to be, I guess you would call it a au pair or a caregiver for her uncle's baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, so the day she, thank you.
Yeah,
the day she arrived in California the day they opened Golden Gate Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And her uncle took her out there, so she walked on the bridge the day it was open.
Really?
Yeah.
How exciting.
She was there.
So what year, what that was 1937.
Seven. And imagine this corn-fed farm girl coming out from the rural South. So Southern Illinois, they refer to themselves as Southerners.
Southerners, right.
And they are.
Yeah, yeah, relatives.
Southern culture and all the stuff that goes with it. Anyway, so going out in the city of San Francisco, she said she set up for 3 days because they couldn't afford it, you know. Anyway, and then the day she arrived, walked across the Golden Gate Bridge. That was her introduction to California.
How exciting.
It was great. Yeah, she was here all of her life from that point on. My father's side, so that would be the Grillos and the Gillicks. My grandfather was James Grillo, and my grandmother was a Gillick. and they were pioneer families that came here in the 1850s. That's how long I'm
specifically to Volcano?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I am fifth generation, my children are sixth.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I wasn't born here. My dad, I'm the only generation that was not actually born and raised here.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad was, and my children were, but not me. Anyway.
So your father, James Grillo.
My father, Wilson.
But your grandfather.
My grandfather was James Grillo.
And he came out here in the 18th. No,
my great-grandfather.
Who was
Giacomo Grillo. Giacomo Grillo. And that they lived on a ranch outside of town, a place called Pioneer Flat. That's where he had a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Long story. I'm getting ahead of myself here. My Italian great-grandfather left Italy in the 1850s, and the story goes he stowed away on the family comes from the town of Chiavari in Liguria near Genoa.
Okay.
in Italy. Stowed away on a boat in the harbor in Genoa. The idea was, why he stowed away, I don't know. I'd love to go back to Italy. I've been there once, but spend some time and find out why, even if that was his real name.
Mm-hmm.
Because Italians, when they left Italy, and in those days, even now I think, they take the name Grillo, because it means cricket, jumping around everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they, Grillo. This is an odd little aside, and it makes people laugh, and makes me laugh too, but my great-grandfather's name was Giacomo Grillo, and that would translate to Jiminy Cricket.
Oh my.
Imagine.
Very clever.
Yeah, very clever. Anyway, so, James or Jiminy. So, that's funny. Anyway, he chose poorly. The idea was to go to Boston, where apparently he had relatives. He chose really poorly because the thing left to the Pillars of Hercules, straight to Gibraltar, and instead of going straight, turned a hard left and went out to the Great Southern Sea across the Pacific.
Oh.
Long way. Anyway, they caught him. They caught him in the middle, and they're going to toss him overboard. He begged and pleaded, please don't do this, you know, all this. So when he had stashed stuff, but they took it all, clothes, money perhaps, whatever. And when he arrived in San Francisco in the 1850s, I've been told 1856, 57, he walked off the boat. He had his shoes, his pants, and a shirt. That was it. And that was all. The family story is that he walked some distance. I've heard the word number 50. It might have been 50 feet, 50 yards. And met somebody he knew in Italy.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that person loaned him $50. In those days, that was
a fortune. Yes.
And he walked. So many walked. Their horses were very rare in California in those days. So they took what they called Shank's mare, which means you walk. Shank's mare. And he walked to Volcano.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, he worked in the gold fields,
mm-hmm.
worked, God knows, doing what all, and finally got enough money to establish a ranch out of Pioneer Flat.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets sketchy. The Grillo mm-hmm. side is not, there's not so much stories told as the Gibbick side, but as I understand it, sent for either his wife, we're not sure, or his girlfriend 12 years later. And she joined him.
And who was that?
His last name, Maria Giglieri. G-H-I-G Giglieri.
There's pictures of them down there, isn't there, at the hall?
No pictures of them.
No pictures at all? I thought there was one picture of the two.
Then. Might have been of her sister or something.
Oh, okay.
But
really?
But that was her family name.
Okay.
And then they had 10 children, I've been told. Several died.
Go ahead, stop.
Pause it.
Pause it. Can you do it?
It's a phone, nowhere else. My wife has it.
Okay, good.
Okay.
We had the pause it yet, so I don't.
And they had 10 children, and not not many of those children had children. But in any recording? Yeah?
Yes.
In any case, there were five boys, five men, young men, and they started Grillo Brothers General Store in Volcano. And I want to say in the 1880s or 1890s. And the store was there, you know, where the Volcano Theater Company amphitheater is. And then there's stage lights and there's a fence there. But between the end of that amphitheater and where the Wells Fargo ruins are, that was the Grillo Brothers store. And that was theirs till they closed the store in the 1920s. So they ran a general store and had business interests throughout the area in the county for all that time.
Do you remember what some of the business interests were?
They owned a lot of times about that time. The mining interest wore out, ran out. So a lot of people would come to him and say, you know, it's October and I got my family to feed and I happen to have this 20-acre gold claim. I'll trade you for winter supplies. So they acquired land all around here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never worth, well, up until recently, never worth anything. So they sold it off for anything that they could get for it. Now, of course, if he kept it, I wouldn't be talking to you. I would be living in some penthouse in San Francisco.
Hey, you'd have a penthouse here.
This would be the summer home, you see, and we'd have the tower in the city. Anyway,
well, you still would be talking to us.
Maybe. You know.
Stop.
I don't know if I'd lower myself to talking to people that brought flies around. Anyway.
Your fly.
So anyway, and they had all these mining claims. They had timber harvest. They ran. He was a butcher as well. The Grillo Brothers did all kind of stuff. They had a general store, a butcher shop, an undertaking parlor. And the odd part about that is, and
the butcher shop was with the undertaker's parlor.
Yes, where the wine bar is now, that was their butcher shop, and in the back was the undertaking parlor, and I always thought that was really creepy.
It is.
And there used to be, even in my lifetime, there was, at the very, when I was very young, except for I don't remember it, but I know that I was alive, wasn't there one of the old hearses, the horse-drawn hearses, still parked back there for
yep.
a while?
And it went to Sacramento and vanished. And I have a story about that hearse.
Oh, well, you'll have to tell us later. Or you could tell us now.
Oh, well, I'll get around to it then. So, a lot of things, the Grillo Brothers got involved in a lot of things. They did everything on account, hardly any cash was, you know, passed around. It was a general store, a rural general store. And did you kill George?
I killed George, I think.
Poor George. Anyway, they would, of course there were no phones, but until later, but you could call ahead or send ahead. They always said send ahead. They would send somebody with a message or they'd come in and they would order things, whether it would be anything from food to boots to shoes to mining equipment to lumbering equipment to Levi's to rounds of cheese to I have their ledger here, mm-hmm. some of them, and coffee. They, you know, anyway, and they would deliver it to you. They had they had several wagons mm-hmm. and several buckboards and horses, and they would deliver. So that's how they made their business.
You have pictures of...
I do have a picture or two of that. Yeah. Anyway, one of the things they did, and this ties into the Gillicks, a guy named Tom Gillick, who was my grandmother's brother, elder brother, was a mining engineer or a miner, and he bought or acquired a mining claim called the Cleveland Tunnel, the Cleveland Claim. Mm-hmm. And they drove this tunnel, not a shaft, but a tunnel, back into where they thought there would be gold-bearing gravel.
And where is this Cleveland Tunnel?
I'll get around to that. And they drove it back in there, and they hit an aquifer. And the water was running so strong that with 19th century technology, they couldn't stay ahead of it. They closed it. And the water kept running out of that tunnel. And to this day, that water is our town water source.
Oh, my gosh.
It runs, it's gravity-fed. It runs out of there. Right now we're making 50 gallons a minute every day, 24 hours a day. So the Cleveland Tunnel is up on Charleston Grade, about half a mile up there. And that's our water source. And how that came about is that gets back to the Grillos. Mrs. Grillo, who lived over there, who never spoke English, never learned, and my great-grandfather never learned
either.
Maria and Giacomo.
And where did they live?
Right across the street. Finally, they moved off the ranch and moved into that little house right across the street.
On the southwest corner of Plug and Constellation.
Okay.
So, everybody had wells in Volcano, and the water coming out of this valley is full of iron. It just is horrible stuff. And so, the sheets were always yellow and orange, and Mrs. Grillo, who came from Italy, for whom clean white sheets was a big freaking deal, okay? She went to her son, my grandfather, and told him in Italian, I want white sheets. You bring that water down there, it's good water, you bring it to my house so I can have white sheets. And Mrs. Grillo had the whitest sheets in town. And so everybody said to my grandfather, could we just tap onto that? And so the Grillo brothers got into the water business. They hated it. They never wanted to do it because it was a pain, but everybody hooked on.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
I recall my grandmother, she was all that was left, and she was running it. And they finally sold it to the Volcano Community Services District was formed in the early 70s. It would have to have been after 73 because that's when the CSD law was, or 71, that's when the CSD law was passed. But up until then, she ran the water district.
Oh,
and everybody paid her $2.25 a month for all the water they could use.
It was...
not metered.
It was so amazing back then. And the water was delicious.
It still is.
Although now we're having to treat it.
Well...
and that's because we now have... before there were no... There was hardly anybody with a home up above the valley, right? Mm-hmm. The watershed came into the Cleveland Tunnel and disrupted the cleanliness of the water.
Oh.
Now it's changed a bit.
It actually, yes and no, not really. The problem, this is kind of,
you know more than I do, but I know
this is probably going. You know, this is kind of filling the circle. I am now a director of the Volcano Community Service District, and I'm in charge of the water system, but as a public agency. I don't own it. I have no fiduciary. I have responsibility for it, but it's not my family's property anymore. So anyway, we have to filter it by law, because we have to abide by the same rules and laws as the city of San Francisco or the city of L.A. Even though we're only a tiny little district, the state government and the federal government, being what they are, they don't give a rip that we can tell them that it's been coming down the hill.
They've got their fingers in everything.
That it's been coming down the hill untainted for 100 years or more, and that the water is beautiful and clean. We have to filter it in order for them to say that it's potable. But we have these filter bags in the processing plant. And in most districts, you have to change those filter bags. The water goes through. You have to change those filter bags out once a month. We change ours out once a year because by law we have to, and they're as wide as the day they went in.
Oh, wow.
They're beautiful. Yeah, this water is absolutely delicious.
It's really a godsend for them.
It was better tasting before they had to do all the things that they have to do now to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the change in flavor.
Yeah.
I mean, immediately.
Yeah.
That it was like, why can't we shut that off?
Yeah.
And the first water treatment that we had was right down there by the hotel, wasn't it?
Which we're taking out soon.
Yes, I know. It's going to be great.
Anyway, so that's the Grillo side in a nutshell, if you will. This is a funny story. I'll relate it. One of the Grillo brothers.
Which one?
I'm going to rent it now. One of the brothers, everybody called him Balila, which that's the name I always heard about this guy. He died when he was 36 or so, came down the hill, broke his neck. His horse fell on him.
Oh.
So he died at a young age. But everybody, my dad, who knew him perhaps, everybody referred to this guy as Balila, which in Italian means the pretty one.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, it was a very cruel joke because he was so ugly he'd stop a train. Balila and this, Balila that. So, okay. And we named our son Dominic. Had no idea that there was anybody named Dominic in the family. Well, Belila's real name was Dominic. So during the wedding, my daughter's wedding, he and a bunch of his cousins from back east and around went up to the cemetery. They were smoking dope or something up there, whatever, drinking. And he came back and he said, "Dad, who's Dominic Grillo?" "That's his name." So he said, I told him the story, so that's.
And he never knew that before then.
I knew it, but I never told him much because it didn't matter because he wasn't named after.
No, he wasn't. But
Balila, he's named after is the name we just picked.
You just liked it.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was Balila. Then there was Frank and John, my dad, my grandfather, James, Balila, another one. I don't know all their names. I don't really have that. Let me back up again. When I was a child, I told you I came here in the summertime. I was, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And the Gillick side, very long-lived, lived. Okay? And they would come here and sit in that kitchen and talk and tell stories. This is the Irish side, not the Italian side. And my uncle, James, who was a history teacher and a PE teacher, would force me, and I was just, I didn't want to do this. All I wanted to do was get the hell out of here and go play in the trees. He would force me to sit here. He says, "You sit here and listen to that. You remember this, because these people aren't going to be around much longer." So they would sit, these Gillicks, and tell the stories, and half of them two-thirds of them I can't remember because I really didn't want to know. Dumb me, but still, I was a kid, so that's my excuse.
Normal.
Anyway, the Gillicks came here. They came down from Northern California and came here in the late 1850s, 58, 59. My grandmother's mother was Margaret Ann McGee Gillick. And her father was Colwell McGee, who was a wagon master and had brought two trains across on the Oregon Trail.
Mm-hmm.
He brought his family across on the third train. When she crossed, and this is how they referred to it. They didn't say, they say they crossed.
They crossed.
They crossed. So I heard a lot of this 19th century nomenclature from these folks. She crossed when she was 6 years old
mm-hmm.
in a family wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And told the story of her mother. Every day, her mother would stop. They would build a fire. And there's a black tea kettle there in the hearth. That was in the wagon. They would cook on it. And in it. And every day, she had long, reddish, dark hair.
Mm-hmm.
And she would brush out her hair. And the Indians, the Sioux Indians, when they were in the Sioux territory, would come up to the wagon just to watch her comb her hair out.
Mm-hmm.
And Colwell McGee was apparently a big, strong man. And the Indians, but it was on the plains. It may have been the Sioux, it may have been the Mandans, it may have been, who knows who it was, but they were aggressive. And they came up to the wagon train. And so he went out to meet them. And what he did was he offered to shake their hand, which was a new thing to them. But he was a big, strong man. He would grip their, this is a story I heard, he would grip their hand so hard that he put them right down to the ground. And that's the biggest, strongest brave he could find. He'd shake his hand and put him right down to the ground. And that's how they got through without getting any trouble, because he was just...
Without a blow struck.
They just respected him.
It was like counting coup. It's very much like counting coup.
And the other story I had from them is, of course, I was laughing once because we had gone to Reno or Tahoe, and the billboards had this Reno or bust, and this picture of a 49er or a pioneer, and I was making light of it. And all these Gillicks who were in their 80s and so on looked at me and said, "That's not funny." And one of my great uncles or aunts said, "You know what they call the Oregon Trail?" And I said, "This is the longest graveyard in the world." And when they met, literally what happened was you got in your wagon and you headed out, and there was no going back. And you either made it or you died. That was it. So they had a wagon full of stuff, and they had seed corn, and they had a rooster, and some hens. And then we're in the middle of nowhere. I was, on the plain, somewhere, God knows, Nebraska, who knows, Kansas, really nowhere. The rooster got into the seed corn. So my great-great-grandmother held down, you couldn't lose either. The rooster was important, the seed corn was important, and without either, you might die. She cut open the crop of the rooster, pulled out the seed corn, sewed him up, and both the corn and the rooster survived.
Oh my God! What an amazing story!
That is
big
a funny
deal.
Story.
Now that is very.
I've never heard that one. Never
heard one
like
that. That is amazing, and not only that, but it is totally and completely sensible. Somebody being. Not panicking, just saying, this is what I have to do, so this is what I do.
And did it. And the rooster survived.
That is awesome.
Had the corn when they got to Oregon. The first thing, they went to Northern California or Oregon. He was a teamster. He was a wagon master. And as I understand it, I think he was in Oregon first. The reason they came down here was that... he's trying to run wagons in the mud. It rained up there all the time. He got really tired of that. So it's probably the Willamette Valley. And finally came down here. And so Margaret Ann McGee, Gillick later, they lived around here. And eventually she met a guy named Terence Gillick, who was an Irish immigrant. Another guy that ran off from our... long story short, they had 13 children. 14 children, 13 survived. My grandmother was one of them. One of the 13. They lived on a ranch out on the creek road. As you go out, it's kind of a broad, flat area. Their ranch is out there.
Is that where the chestnut tree still is? That's where the chestnut tree is, on the other side of the street.
Out on the creek, road. Yes, that was the Gillick Ranch.
Oh my God, that's why Ray Hale always knew where to go for the chestnuts. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So, and there were, like I say, there were 13 that survived, and my grandmother was one of them, and they would. Not all of them would be around. A lot of them went. Some of them went to L.A. or San Francisco or whatever.
How many still are in this area?
None. There's like John, who lives across the street. He's my second cousin. His son, John Jr., would be my third cousin.
Lives in Pine Grove.
Pine Grove. But they scattered to the wind. I must have hundreds of second cousins. Or even first cousins.
Gillick's all over California.
But don't
who knows
where
they went? And they just didn't stay in touch.
Mm-hmm.
On the Grillo side, there were very few kids after the first wave of kids. I was an only child. I had one cousin in San Francisco, but he died. So that left me. I'm the only child of all those people.
Oh my.
Yeah. And now we're having...
No, that's surprising.
It is very surprising. My wife, her family is from Pittsburgh, and when we were first married, we went back there to kind of like a wedding reception a year later. There must have been 100 people in her parents' yard, and they were all related, first, second cousins, aunts, uncles. Amazing family. But I had never experienced that. So all the people that I knew who were my relatives were these old folks who were dying off. I can recall being a kid and going to one funeral after another until my father said, that's enough. He's not going to any more. He didn't want me exposed to all these dead people. So I stopped going to him because he just put his foot down. Now, my grandmother, of course, they were her brothers and sisters. Sisters.
Yeah, but that they didn't have that many children is amazing.
No, they didn't, but it was like her brothers and sisters. They were like 80 and 90.
Right.
Then they would die, and she'd want me to go to the funeral my dad said, that's enough. After about three of them, I was starting to get, I was
getting a little morbid for a kid.
Yeah, I was a young guy, and I put on a wool suit and tie and be weird with these people, all these old dead people.
That you didn't even know, really, very well.
I knew them
but
better than you might think, because they were here a lot.
That's true, right here, yeah.
And so...
You're the people whose stories you had been listening to.
Yes, the same folks whose stories, but they were telling stories of their parents.
Right.
So, but the stories they told, were amazing. My great-grandmother, Margaret, he died in 1937, and that was her house right across the street. She died in 1937 and was alive as a child in the 1860s when volcano was really booming. So I had some stories from her. One is pertaining to that hearse we were talking about, and old Abe the cannon. During the 1860s, there was an outfit called the Volcano Blues. They were a Union militia, and they drilled and maintained the Armory Hall, which today is the third version of that. So, because of the way the world was in the United States, I guess, there were a lot of Southerners here. Apparently, I guess it was an aristocracy then, and the firstborn child got the plantation, and the others were christening the wind.
And so they came out here to go mining.
So they come out here. So a lot of folks were from Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, Virginia, and they were Southern sympathizers. And of course, the war came. And the Blues heard that the Confederates, who called themselves, this is a story I heard here at the table, the Knights of the Southern Cross, the Knights of the Golden Cross, or whatever it was, something
like
Knights
that.
Of something.
Yes,
anyway, they I don't know how they are going to do this, because gold weighs a lot, but they were going to take the gold. That's why I heard it was cut. They're going to take to the shop. They're going to take the gold and take it south. Whether they're going to take a shipment or a lot of it or commandeer the whole valley, and who knows? I have no idea how they're going to do that, because it's heavy stuff. How are they going to get it? Anyway, so the captain of the Blues, a guy named Mr. Murphy, and there's a connection there because Evelyn Gabarini's mother was Captain Murphy's daughter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Okay, so Mr. Captain Murphy of the Volcano Blues went to... Now there's a match for you. Gilligan Murphy. All Irish. Anyway, so... went to the Presidio. And I, from the story that I've been told, it's clear to me that government hasn't changed much. They went to the Presidio and said, you know, we have these Southerners. They're gonna commandeer the gold fields. They're gonna take over Volcano. They're gonna take the gold south. And the
powers that be.
Well, the officers there at the Presidio wrang their hands and pulled their beards and said, well, we haven't got a budget to do send up any troops because. But he said, there's an old Mexican War cannon barrel sitting on the dock. If you want that, you can have it. So they said, well, that's something. So they had it shipped by boat to Sacramento.
Oh, man.
Of course, that's all, you know,
right up the river.
That's the only way you do it.
Right, right up the river.
And then they took that hearse down to Sacramento and put the cannon in a casket and brought it up here in the dark of night so that the Southerners wouldn't know they had to bring it up here. And then they built the carriage, the caisson, and all that in a blacksmith, which is basically where the Juggernaut's garden is now, apparently.
Yep, that's where the blacksmith... Well, actually, was that where it was, or was it right next to Adam's cabin? Wasn't the blacksmith shop part of the brewery, behind the brewery?
Might have been behind...
I think it was behind the brewery.
It was in that area.
Yeah.
So they built it in there. And this, you know, there's some contention whether this really actually happened or whether it was kind of a tall tale that grew over the years. But I tend to think that it happened.
And just may have grown a little taller.
May have gone a little bit taller than it did. But they built the cannon. They set it up on the carriage. They had the case on. Now, these guys were miners. They knew explosives. They were used to it. And like my great uncle Oney, who was a miner, he lived here. Oney would say things like, well, if you're going to blow something up, one's good, two's better, and three's the trick. Which means, blow that sucker up. Don't fool around with it. So, that's what I understand they did with that cannon. They didn't just fill it. They filled it to the brim. Powder, nails, God knows what all. And they rolled it out in Union Square, just right where the corner of Main and Constellation is now. And they were standing in front of the cannon. I've been told they were standing in front of the cannon. Nobody could see behind this line of Union militia. And the Southerners come marching down this way, and they said something like, well, now y'all got to move ahead because there's a whole bunch of us and none of you. We got you. And they parted, the Union parted ranks, and there's a guy holding a fuse over Old Abe. And that was the end of the war. Everybody decided, they don't want to.
It's not worth it.
Let's go have a drink and talk about this later. Anyway, so
that shot was fired.
Not a shot was fired. So
too bad. That would have been exciting.
Well, here's the deal.
More exciting than it didn't.
Later on, a couple of days later, they realized they didn't know how to unload a cannon.
Oh dear.
Ah yes.
So they sit down, which means they probably, I think there was telegraph here, but they sit down, however they got down to the Presidio, and said, you better come up here and show us how to undo this thing. Now this is the story I got from my grandmother, from her mother, who was alive then and saw this. The guy they sent up was just a jerk. You know, starched shirt, polished brass buttons, rat and rod straight, you know, shaved tail lieutenant that, you know, he was just an overbearing little, nobody liked him much. But he was an artillery
expert.
He knew what he was doing. And he looked down the barrel of that cannon, I've been told, and his face was ghost white. He said, if you damn fools, this is the quote I have from my grandmother, from her mother, if you damn fools had lit this thing off, you would have killed everybody in the square.
They just good, no shot.
Stopped it for everything. So, And this is another part of the story that I have from my grandmother, from her mother. They learned how to undo it, and they learned how to light the thing off and not kill anybody except
who they were supposed to kill.
Supposed, but never shot. I don't think it was ever fired in anger.
No.
But it was used. It was used as a deterrent. You know, we got a cannon, and you don't. So don't fool around. Anyway, this has happened in 1862. So throughout the war, whenever there was a Union victory, they would, as I was told, they would. My grandmother said they would send boys, young boys, around town, and tell Union houses to put up your windows. And they'd take Old Abe, put a blank charge in it, maybe a double, I don't know, but a large charge in it, run it down Constellation, and let it off, and the concussion would blow the glass out of the Confederate houses. So, and in those, yeah, and in those days, that was a cold thing to do because you didn't just go to the store and get glass.
No.
You had to go down and have it
shipped from Sacramento. And sometimes you had to have it shipped from San Francisco to Sacramento to get it up here. They didn't just
so you could always tell the Confederate houses because they had wax paper, you know, something in the window.
With the glass in the window?
Yeah, it was, that's what they did. And I can recall the last time it was fired, I was up here, but I might have been nine, a little, maybe even younger. I might have been up here with my parents, and I might have been like six or seven, a little guy. And my grandmother was terrified of the thing, and they were going to light it off, and she had me go into that bedroom, and I was not permitted to leave until that cannon had been fired. And I heard it, but I didn't see it. And that's the last, that might have been 1956.
And that was the last time it was fired.
Far as I know.
So you were there.
That,
you were
if
there.
It was 1956, I was here too.
You were.
But I don't remember hearing anything about this. So I think it might have been before. Are you sure? Well, what year were you born?
47.
Okay, so mom and dad moved here in the end of 48, early 49. So they were here when it was fired.
Mm-hmm. And they would fire it
occasionally for the 4th of July, didn't they?
For the 4th of July, Memorial Day, they would like to stay
up into the 60s, but then they didn't after the 60s. I think that they stopped after that because there was something
the carriage
wasn't going to take it anymore. And it was, there was nobody around to repair it properly, really, at that time.
Yeah, now it's been repaired. I think it could be lit off.
Yeah, probably could be. Well, I think that didn't it get repaired by
Ron Schofield?
Ron Schofield
rebuilt the whole thing,
yeah.
And so it's,
no, so it's in perfect condition.
I'm thinking,
there, I'm sure.
I keep thinking, God, that'd be so cool. Just
fire it at least once.
Just put a quarter charge in there, run it down Constellation, light it, or actually you point it up towards the trees,
you
and light it off.
Pictures and things of it. I'd love to come and forward.
But what I've been told is the smoke it made was just immense.
Oh, well.
Clouds and clouds and clouds of black, of white smoke came out of it.
Oh, well.
Oh, but still,
look at this. Look at Sacramento. When the 4th of July, they do all the fireworks. Have you ever looked at the town down the valley?
Yeah.
After the 4th of July, after the Cal Expo show, it looks like
a war
has happened down there.
So anyway, that's...
Oh, that is awesome. I've never heard all of that story. I've heard parts of that story, but I haven't heard all of it.
Yeah.
That is just...
It could be done
wonderful.
Again. You guys.
Oh, yeah. I think we should do that. You're the services district.
Yeah.
Let's work on it.
Anyway, that's a lot of the stuff that I know.
It's not all of it. He has more stories.
He has so much more, I guess.
But we could do this again.
What we've always done is when somebody suddenly goes into
shutdown mode.
That's the time, to end this interview. However we can do another one.
Yeah.
Anytime you wish, when you think of more. And what I suggest is writing, just keeping a jog going where you write down.
So I have it all up here.
Oh, right. This story, we can set another time.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
But one more little thing is that when my grandfather grew up, this would be in the early 1900s.
This was your grandfather?
My grandfather. Jim Grillo.
Sadie,
my dad's father. Sadie
Jim
husband.
Senior. Jim Senior.
Yeah. Not the Italian, but the guy that was born here.
Right.
They were rough kids. They they had a group, they called themselves the Tar Flat Gang. And, you know,
the Tar Flat Gang.
And if they had, this is a story I heard from my dad. And if they had done this stuff now, they'd all get slapped in prison because the stuff they did was really, really tough, rough. They played little jokes. They were really hard on people. There was an old guy who lived up on Indian Hill, and he was irascible. He would throw things at the kids, and he had a stick that he'd beat him with.
Who was it? Do you remember?
I forget his name. Maybe it'll come to me. My dad, I heard it several times, the story, so the name may come back. But so, my grandfather and his cronies, the Tar Flat, they were teenagers. They got one of these great big 12-foot, 20-foot round metal mining wheels, wagon wheels, hauled it up above his house. Yeah, and let it go. It went right through his house. He heard it coming, sat up in bed and pulled his legs up. If he hadn't, he would have cut his legs right off, right through his bed and out the other side.
Oh, good heavens,
my
I know.
God.
You're not sure whether to laugh or to look horrified or both.
We both look so horrified, but now we'll laugh. Because nothing bad happened except for the half house was cut in half.
The house was cut in half and his bed was cut in half.
Oh my gosh.
Oh,
okay.
So he heard the roar of it coming down the hill.
And he was like,
he sat up and pulled his legs up. But they spent who knows how many days hauling this damn thing up the hill. And positioning it and waiting for the right time. I'm sure they had a grand old time letting it go, but if they'd done it now, both in prison. Hello.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good place to end this interview. we sure want to hear more about that.
Now, I knew Jim Grillo. And when I was a little kid, and as I grew up until he passed away.
You couldn't have. He died in 1947.
Okay, I knew the son.
You knew his son, James.
Okay, I knew James. Okay, yeah. Okay, see, I knew that there was something going on there with the ages, of course. So Sadie's husband, when he was a little kid, did that.
Yeah, well, teenager.
Teenager.
Well, yeah, teenager.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
There's also...
But you know, those were harder times anyway. I've known so many people who even in the 30s talk about the fist fights they were in and so on that would have definitely pulled you into prison nowadays. But people
don't
just handle things...
Yeah, they handle them themselves.
Then, you know? And it certainly ended a lot of arguments, many of those fights. And,
well, yeah, and you knew if you pushed it the wrong way, someone was going to smack you in the jaw.
Right.
You know?
And that would be the end of it.
That would be the end of it.
That would be the
knock
end of
you down
it.
And that's it.
It was over.
Now know. It would start a war.
Now there'd be God knows what all.
Yeah.
There's also something that is endemic, not endemic, but particular to Volcano. And this has to do with where Ann lives now. That used to be, it was the Volcano baseball park.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather, James, Jim Grillo, was... There was a baseball team, a ball camp. They had V's on their shirts, and they played damn good ball. He was a pitcher and a first baseman. He had a hell of a fastball. He was so good, the Cleveland Indians offered him a spot. He wouldn't leave Volcano. He wouldn't leave Amador County. That killed him, eventually. But, well, he had a phlebitis.
Oh.
And he would not go. My grandmother wanted him to go down to University of San Francisco, California Medical Center in San Francisco, and have it taken care of. He wouldn't leave Amador County until he died when he was in his early 60s.
That's why he
should have lived in his 90s, but just because of that, he wouldn't. That whole generation of people would not leave the county for whatever reason. They just couldn't get him out of here.
There's a few throwbacks to that now. John Gillick is one of them.
Yeah, and his sister Rosie, she wouldn't leave.
Yeah,
I don't think she ever left.
No, I don't think she ever went out of this county for anything.
Yeah.
Ever.
Ever.
I'm not even sure she ever went beyond Jackson.
I know. Yeah. Anyway, so not only was my grandfather a star baseball player, his would be my grandmother's nephew, but... became like a son because she raised him here. Larry Gillick, he was a sheriff of Butte County for 20 years. But before World War II, He was a star pitcher and first baseman, and he and my grandfather were very close. And he hurt his arm and couldn't throw hard anymore. Before the war, he was given several offers to play for East Coast teams. So that runs the family, baseball. Although I didn't do any of it, but there you go.
And yet they would not leave.
I'm sorry?
They would not leave.
Well, my grandfather wouldn't, but Larry did. Larry desperately wanted to play baseball. His son, Patrick, became manager of the Toronto Blue Jays and coached them, managed them to the World Series. And Larry was still alive when it happened. He was just,
how awesome.
It was just awesome. He went back and saw his son manage a
that's
World Series
who I had met. I've met Larry.
You met Larry.
I remember he was the sheriff up there.
Yeah.
I've met him a number of times.
I can recall how thrilled he was. And my grandma was still alive. Mm-hmm. And that his son was managing after, you know, all this time, all these people in baseball, finally his son Patrick managed the world championship team.
That's pretty awesome.
It is. Larry's heritage, and Larry knew that when he was managing it.
Yes.
Now, Larry used to come down here for family gatherings here, at Sadie's.
Mm-hmm.
What did he usually drink when he was down here? Do you remember?
No, he and my dad were closer than his. They were more like brothers than my. James and my dad.
Yeah, because
I think they drank a lot of bourbon.
Okay, because I remember because they were here in like in how what year did Larry die?
Oh, not until the 70s.
Okay, good. I am remembering correctly because I had Moki, my horse Moki, back then, a little POA. I used to ride all over town and stuff, and I would come by here, ride up the street from here around the corner so that I could ride up Jackass Gulch and go for long rides. But I'd stop off if there was a gathering here, and I'd get to stop and say hi to everybody, and everybody would say hi and pet my horse and everything. And and Larry would give my horse drinks. My horse really liked it.
this is a good story. This is something that I recall distinctly because I might have been 10 or 11. And my dad and his uncle would be Oni, who lived here. Oni was, you know, big guy.
I have pictures of Oni.
And was an Irishman who was fond of his drink. But he and my dad had this thing. They kid themselves. You know, always playing practical jokes on each other. So my dad, we were coming up here, and he stopped in Stockton, a hot August. God, it was hot in the valley, like a blast furnace. And I can recall he coming out holding this paper bag. Laugh, he's so funny. I got some of the worst goddamn rot gut I could find. And it was, I guess, whiskey, bourbon. Stuck it in the trunk of the car over the radiator. Okay. So he drives up here, says hello to his mother, I pile out, and there's Oni in the backyard right there, and he's sawing on wood. The Gillicks all cut wood, but he all by hand, you know, back then, he's cutting wood. And he chews tobacco all the time. Big. So my dad comes up to him and says, "Hey, Oni, you want a drink?" And Oni says, "Why, sure, I'll have a drink." So my dad pours him a water glass full of this friggin' lighter fluid, right? And Oni goes, "Stuff like his water." Puts it down, puts his jaw back in, keep right on cutting wood. Just the meat.
And your dad was going,
Exactly. Why, you old fart? He says, "Why didn't you fall down?" Some damn kids these days. Like a man. That's my only story.
Okay, so we stop now and
yes.
We'll come
well,
back.
Well, every time we stop, we try to stop.
I know,
a beautiful story.
You've got great stories.
I'll say.
I've been dying to get over here to get stories from you, Terry.
Well, the other part of it is I'm a writer and editor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a storyteller. That's what
yeah.
I do for a living.
And you're doing a good job on
well,
this one.
Well, that's genetic. My father's the same. Although he was not in the media in any way, my dad could walk into a room full of people and not know anybody. My mother would just get livid over this. And in 20 minutes, everybody in the room would be around him and he'd be telling stories. And she and I'd be sitting alone. Well, my grandfather was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
He had that store down there, and people would come into that store just to hear Jim Grillo tell stories.
No.
So that.
That's a great heritage you have.
And the term is we're all vaccinated with phonograph needles.
Really, that's funny.
They're biphonograph needles.
Yeah, my dad had one. One of his sayings was that what was it? How did he say it? It was like, no one was a stranger. I can't remember. I'll have to think about what exactly.
So the paraphrasing was about this area.
Yeah, well, certain people that you'd go into a place and someone could be in a room full of strangers but no one really was a stranger at that point because mm-hmm. it would draw people to them because of the stories they could tell or just the way that mm-hmm. they could.
Yeah.
Communicate
well,
with people.
That goes with
yeah.
Larry too.
Yeah.
Larry Gillick. Larry's a lot of Gillick, Sadie's siblings. Three of the brothers died during a flu epidemic of 1918. As a matter of fact, my dad was born in 1918. She got the flu and was pregnant with him and got pneumonia and survived. She was tough.
Mm-hmm.
Lived to be almost 100 years old. Anyway. How's it going with that? Oh, Larry. He was sheriff of Butte County, but you get a bunch of these Gillicks. This is the Gillick side, the Irish side. My dad and him and Larry's brother Terry, and the name runs in the family, and a couple other, and they could just talk for days, tell stories and yak and carry on. And Larry, of course, was sheriff of Butte County for, I want to say, almost 30 years.
Yeah, he went through a lot of terms up there.
Nobody ran against him. Every now and again, someone would try to run against him, but...
He couldn't win.
Yeah. Funny story. He was a baseball player, you know. He had his hell of an arm, even though he is injured. He had a... And until they actually forced him to carry a sidearm, like mm-hmm. in the call this, he was almost through with his... career, he never carried a gun. He refused to. He carried rocks in his pocket. You know,
because
truck,
he could get you good.
He would knock them flat down on the ground with that rock, man.
Fantastic.
His favorite thing was they'd be running away. He'd hit them right in the back, right there, and just pull them out.
Fantastic.
Never discharged his firearm. Never carried one.
Until the very end when he had to.
When they had to by law because, and he fought it. He tried not, I can recall him sitting here talking to my grandmother that he has to carry a gun now.
Sheriff without a sidearm.
Yeah.
He's probably the only one in history.
Probably the only one. He just, and he was one of these guys that he had, his idea of being a sheriff was people would get thrown in jail and he would tell them, okay, you're not going to sit in jail. You're going to go out and do community work. We're going to have pancake breakfast, and you're going to cook, and you're going to do this and that. And he had these huge breakfasts and dinners, and he had his inmate do it all. No, you can't do that now. But that's how he ran his sheriff's department.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way they should be run.
Community service.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's the way they should be run.
And
yeah.
So a lot of these guys.
And that would be a whole discussion.
That's how Arapaho in Arizona would like to do it. I know he's doing it in a different way and very unorthodox, and people are very upset with him a lot of the time. But I think if he could do it the way that Larry did it, I think he would much prefer doing it that way, where they had to go out and do community service. As it is, he has them go out and do some community mm-hmm. service and stuff. But because that was a better way to do it. That's how Preston Castle was.
Yeah, you're truly paying your debt to society.
And not only that, but take care of yourself. You know,
learn some skills.
Learn skills.
The thing that I recall about Larry Gillick and the stories, of course, getting around to this, he was raised as as one of my grandmother's sons. His father died. His mother, something happened to her, but she raised him. He was a bit older than my dad, but they were like, the three of them were like brothers. He grew up here and referred to her as mother all of his life. Where was I going with that?
Have you loved volcano?
No. I would hear him tell stories to her as a son would talk to his mother, and he would say, you know, I've got to carry a gun now, I don't want to do it. And she'd say, well, I don't want you to get hurt. You better carry a gun. He says, I don't need a gun. Nobody has to worry about it. I can knock him down. But every now and again, he'd come here with inmates that he were trustees, where we like they became friends. And so he had his own little rejuvenation
rehab program
going on one to one, but it was one to one.
You started out talking about how Larry would tell stories. That was what you were getting.
Yeah, and the whole there's two sides to my family, to my dad's family, my dad's side, and that is the Grillos, and they're Italian, they're a little stoic. Northern Italians are not flamboyant. They tend to be rather reserved, and yeah, so they were. But the other side is Irish. And dang, they were Irish. I mean, there was dancing.
After the Irish side.
There was dancing and singing going on here, and just a grand old time. But the Irish side, the Italians not so much. Although my grandmother married this Italian guy, and learned to speak the language, and learned to cook the Italian food, so that when he came home from the store, the food at the table was the same food that his mom cooked.
Oh. Bless her heart.
Well, yeah, one of the things the Irish don't do is food. Not well.
No, and, but it's always pretty much the same.
But the Italians, I grew up with an Italian kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
The smell of her kitchen was just amazing.
Mm-hmm. I got to eat here.
The raviolis came out of here. They were just, yeah. Pesto and wow.
Yeah.
The food here was pretty good.
And the place smells wonderful.
Yeah.
Always.
A lot of spices in her cabinets that she kept. Italian spices.
I think that's why my mom and she loved each other so much was the food. Well, one of the reasons. But my mother loved Sadie. And I think they exchanged a few ideas here and there.
Probably. So,
plus Sadie was one of those women, like you were the interviewing, that a woman that she was a homemaker, but she was a woman of great character.
Strength.
And strength, yes.
She was an Irish Catholic matriarch, if you know what I mean.
I mean, just like the story of her running the Cleveland Tunnel water supply for Volcano. I mean, you know, the other women in town, there weren't too many of them that could have done that at that time.
She was the first forelady of a grand jury in the state of California. Very important to her all of her life. Graduated Volcano School in 1900. Went on to get a degree from the Commercial High School of San Francisco in 1902.
Where did she go to high school? She went to high school at the Ion School, right?
No,
she went directly from grammar school from the Volcano School.
In those days,
it was.
When you got out of grammar school, that was it in Amador County.
At that point, it was a little went farther before they went to high school.
She went to the Commercial High School of San Francisco, graduated to be a secretary, and was the secretary of Market Street in an outfit called Goldberg Bowen. She told me this story many times. That would have made her about 16 or 17 on April 18th, 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived with her sister Julia she was something else. Anyway, her life. And they lived in the Mission, which was in an upper middle class neighborhood. And she told the story that on 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, on April 18th, 1906, she got up. She didn't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the dogs were barking and the cows were lowing, and she decided to go out to the privy on the back porch, opened the door, and the porch walked away 5 feet.
Right in front of her.
Right in front of her. And that was the earthquake.
Wow, a startup there.
And then she lived in the park, and the city burned down around her. Her and her sister, and her sister's husband. And then she got her trunk. I don't know where what kind of trunk it was. It must have had wheels, but she was dragging it down Market Street to the ferry building. Now this is, times were different then, and she never really thought much of this. She thought it was wrong that it was done, but there was a line of Chinese folks that were trying to get on a ferry boat to get the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this white girl calling, you know, hauling her in the big line, and the ticket guy closed his window and opened one for her and sold her a ticket. She got on the boat.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And
what a memory.
Yeah. So, but she said the city was burning for days. And they lived in a park.
Mm-hmm.
And but her sister, Julia.
Julia what?
Julia Gillick. Mm-hmm. But her last name would have been, forget.
Her married name?
Edward. Ed was his first name.
That was her husband?
Yeah. Edward Wood. Wood. Ed Wood. Edward Wood. And he, before... Was it before or after? I'm not sure, because I have photographs. It must have been after, in the early 1900s, after the earthquake, became a streetcar conductor in Honolulu.
All right.
And somewhere in this house...
That makes sense, sure.
I have photographs of them in Honolulu, in the islands. And I've been to Hawaii. And I look at those pictures, and these people are wrapped in so much goddamn clothes. I'm thinking to myself, you guys really don't get it. Women with bathing suits that were basically ball gowns.
But that was the Victorian age.
Yes, it was. And it was unheard of to, you know, actually dress like this.
And the British, when they took over those islands... When they first started going to those islands, they made the natives dress like that too. And many, many, many natives died because of it.
Yes.
Because of the way they were dressed. Because their systems could not deal with it. And they weren't supposed to.
Nobody's supposed to wear clothes in Hawaii.
Not like that.
Woolen. Almost all of that was woolen.
And woolen, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so you see pictures.
Woolen and linen.
That's where my mother grew up, yeah. And yeah, my grandmother.
I see the pictures of these people. I guess it would have been before the war, 1914, but
yeah,
you know,
oh yeah, it was in the early.
And there were women were wearing white.
Yep, Victorian age.
Clear, pure white, but still, how many layers? I mean, it's Hawaii. It's 85 degrees. The water's 85 degrees. What's wrong with you? And the men wearing these dark suits.
Dark suits,
you know,
wool suits. Dark wool suits.
But everybody, people
yeah.
in this family would have
dressed oh, yeah, like that. Like that too.
Everybody would
something.
Dress the same way.
Yep. Yeah. 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 But, yeah, that's amazing. We should find those pictures. That'd be interesting.
Somewhere.
I have pictures of mom when she was a little girl in Hawaii.
I think we should definitely do another section. And you should definitely, because these stories could go on for...
A while.
Another hour.
Well, like I said, you know, exactly as a photograph in Italy, it's a Gillick thing.
But that's fine. Two hours was not
And the thing is, you were getting warmed up here.
Yeah. I
more
really
than warmed up. But
he hasn't even told hardly any stories. He all he did was give a little history of himself.
I haven't said much about being a kid here.
That's right, which we want.
Which we need.
And we also, if you can, at some point here and there, tell some of the stories that you recall like you did now of what you heard stories from other people, because that's what we want too. Because those are, yeah, they may be hearsay, but you remember what they were told. You were told back then, and your memory is pretty doggone good, Terry, for some of those stories. I know I've heard you tell some of them.
They would tell the same story over and over.
Yeah.
One of the things, that's the ancient cat.
I am going to stop.